Hey, it's Otis here. Before we get to the bedtime reading, I wanted to let you know that I just launched a brand new show. It's called The Daily Book Club, a daytime companion to Sleepy, where you hear entire books one chapter at a time, one day at a time. Simple as that. So if Sleepy is how you wind down your day, The Daily Book Club is a great way to start your day. There's new episodes daily. I read in a slightly peppier voice so that you can get really lost in these amazing stories that have stood the test of time. Or, just like Sleepy, you can sit back and relax and zone out to a good book. The first book we'll be reading is The Enchanted April by Elizabeth Von Arnim. Story is, in the 1920s, four women unfulfilled with life take a chance and abscond to a dreamy medieval Italian castle. It's a story dripping with wisteria, the beauty of solitude, and an unlikely pursuit of joy in Portofino, Italy. I think that this is a perfect story for the season, and you can hear it now. Find the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. This show has been a long time coming, and I'm so excited to bring you even more stories. So go subscribe to the Daily Book Club to hear what happens next. Thanks. This episode of Sleepy is proudly sponsored by ButcherBox. If you've listened to Sleepy for a while, you know that I love good food and eating well and treating my body right so that I can take on my days. ButcherBox helps me do exactly that. They deliver super high quality, 100% grass-fed beef and free-range organic chicken, crate-free pork and wild-caught seafood right to your door, humanely raised. No antibiotics or hormones ever, and they have a huge variety to choose from. They have excellent deals, recipes and guides and tips on cooking, and free shipping, always. Eating well is a huge factor in getting a good night's sleep, as is sometimes saving the trip to the grocery store and taking some stress out of your schedule. Well, I have been loving these deliveries. I've been cooking up their steak tips with eggs in the morning, cooked up with a little bit of butter and scallions and soy sauce. And I also made a delicious brined chicken roast with a lemon parsley gravy. Yeah, ButcherBox has made me very happy. Well, today, ButcherBox is giving Sleepy listeners free ground beef for life with your membership, plus an additional $20 off your first order. Use my link, butcherbox.com/sleepy, and use code SLEEPY to get free ground beef for life, plus $20 off your first box. That's butcherbox.com/sleepy and use the code SLEEPY. The link for this will also be in the show notes. Eat well, sleep well. Hey, my name's Otis Gray and you're listening to Sleepy. A podcast where I read old books to help you get to sleep. And this is a midweek bedtime story for you. I hope you've been having a wonderful week so far. And I hope you really enjoy the 2 hours of Edith Wharton for our 300th episode. We are officially in the 300s for Sleepy. And I could not be happier. So, this is a midweek bedtime story for you. Every Wednesday, there'll be shorter stories and little essays, maybe collections of poetry, just smaller bedtime stories for the middle of your week to help you snooze. Our longer episodes, we're going to keep posting every Sunday, as always. And those are going to be the episodes that have longer intros where I get to profoundly thank our Patreon members. And these Wednesday episodes, they'll be just simply shorter shows that have a beginning and an end. And as always, for an ad-free version of Sleepy for just $2 a month, go to patreon.com/sleepyradio or click the blue Sleepy logo in the banner on the top of this Spotify page. And as always, the music you're hearing is by my good friend James Lepkowski. And the cover art for Sleepy is by Gracie Kanan. I really hope you love these midweek stories. And for our 301st episode, I am going to be reading a very, very snoozy cerebral essay called The Color of Life by Alice Meynell. And now is the time for you to fluff up your pillow just how you like it. Feel yourself melt into your bed. Get real comfortable. Close your eyes. And let me read to you. The Color of Life. Red has been praised for its nobility as the color of life, but the true color of life is not red. Red is the color of violence or of life broken open, edited, and published. Or if red is indeed the color of life, it is so only on condition that it is not seen. Once fully visible, red is the color of life violated, and in the act of betrayal and waste. Red is the secret of life, and not the manifestation thereof. It is one of the things, the value of which is secrecy, one of the talents that are to be hidden in a napkin. The true color of life is the color of the body, the color of the covered red, the implicit and not explicit red of the living heart and the pulses. It is the modest color of the unpublished blood. So bright, so light, so soft, so mingled, the gentle color of life is outdone by all the colors of the world. Its very beauty is that it is white, but less white than milk, brown, but less brown than earth, red, but less red than sunset or dawn. It is lucid, but less lucid than the color of lilies. It has the hint of gold that is an all fine color, but in our latitudes the hint is almost elusive. Under Sicilian skies, indeed, it is deeper than old ivory, but under the misty blue of the English zenith and the warm gray of the London horizon, it is as delicately flushed as the paler wild roses out of their utmost, flat as stars in the hedges of the end of June. For months together, London does not see the color of life in any mass. The human face does not give much of it. What with features and beards and the shadow of the top hat and chapeau melon of man and of the veils of woman. Besides, the color of the face is subject to 1,000 injuries and accidents. The popular face of the Londoner has soon lost its gold, its white, and the delicacy of its red and brown. We miss little beauty by the fact that it is never seen freely in great numbers out of doors. You get it in some quantity when all the heads of a great indoor meeting are turned at once upon a speaker. But it is only in the open air, needless to say, that the color of life is in perfection. In the open air, clothed with the sun, whether the sunshine be golden and direct, or dazzlingly diffused in gray. The little figure of the London boy, it is that has restored to the landscape the human color of life. He is allowed to come out of all his ignominies and to take the late color of the midsummer northwest evening on the borders of the Serpentine. At the stroke of 8, he sheds the slough of nameless colors, all ally to the hues of dust, soot, and fog, which are the colors the world has chosen for its boys. And he makes, in his hundreds, a bright and delicate flush between the gray-blue water and the gray-blue sky. Clothed now with the sun, he is crowned by and by with 12 stars as he goes to bathe, and the reflection of an early moon is under his feet. So little stands between a gamin and all the dignities of nature. They are so quickly restored. There seems to be nothing to do, but only a little thing to undo. It is like the art of Eleonora Duse, the last and most finished action of her intellect, passion, and knowledge is, as it were, the flicking away of some insignificant thing mistaken for art by other actors, some little obstacle to the way and liberty of nature. All the squalor is gone in a moment, kicked off with the second boo, and the child goes shouting to complete the landscape with the lacking color of life. You are inclined to wonder that, even undressed, he still shouts with a Cockney accent. You half expect pure vowels and elastic syllables from his restoration, his spring, his slenderness, his brightness, and his glow. Old ivory and wild rose in the deepening midsummer sun, it gives colors to his world again. It is easy to replace man, and it will take no great time, where nature has lapsed, to replace nature. It is always easy to do, by the happily easy way of doing nothing. The grass is always ready to grow in the streets, and no streets could ask for a more charming finish than your green grass. The gasometer even must fall to pieces unless it is renewed, but the grass renews itself. There is nothing so remediable as the work of modern man, the thought which is also, as Mr. Pecksniff said, very soothing. And by remedial, I mean, of course, destructible. As the bathing child shuffles off his garments, they are few, and one brace suffices him. So the land might always, in reasonable time, shuffle off its yellow brick and purple slate, and all the things that collect about railway stations. A single night almost clears the air of London. But if the color of life looks so well in the rather sham scenery of Hyde Park, it looks brilliant and grave indeed on a real seacoast. To have once seen it there should be enough to make a colorist. Oh, memorable little picture. The sun was gaining color as it neared setting, and it set not over the sea, but over the land. The sea had the dark and rather stern, but not cold blue of that aspect, the dark and not the opal tints. The sky was also deep. Everything was definite, without mystery, and exceedingly simple. The most luminous thing was the shining white of an edge of foam, which did not cease to be white, because it was a little golden and a little rosy in the sunshine. It was still the whitest thing imaginable. And the next most luminous thing was the little child, also invested with the sun and the color of life. In the case of women, it is of the living and unpublished blood that the violent world has professed to be delicate and ashamed. See the curious history of the political rights of woman under the Revolution. On the scaffold, she enjoyed an ungrudged share in the fortunes of party. Political life might be denied her, but that seems a trifle when you consider how generously she was permitted political death. She was to spin and cook for her citizen in the obscurity of her living hours. But to the hour of her death was granted a part in the largest interests, social, national, international. The blood wherewith she should, according to Robespierre, have blushed to be seen or heard in the Tribune, was exposed in the public sight, unsheltered by her veins. Against this, there was no modesty. Of all privacies, the last and the innermost, the privacy of death, was never allowed to put obstacles in the way of public action for a public cause. Women might be, and were, duly suppressed when by the mouth of Olympe de Gouges, they claimed a right to concur in the choice of representatives for the formation of the laws. But in her person, too, they were liberally allowed to bear political responsibility to the Republic. Olympe de Gouges was guillotined. Robespierre thus made her public in complete amends. A point of biography. There is hardly a writer now, of the third class, probably not one, who has not something sharp and sad to say about the cruelty of nature. Not one who is able to attempt May in the woods without a modern reference to the manifold death and destruction with which the air, the branches, the mosses are said to be full. But no one has paused in the course of these phrases to take notice of the curious and conspicuous fact of the suppression of death and of the dead throughout this landscape of manifest life. Where are they, all the dying, all the dead of the populous woods? Where do they hide their little last hours? Where are they buried? Where is the violence concealed? Under what gay custom and decent habit? You may see, it is true, an earthworm in a robin's beak, and may hear a thrush breaking a snail's shell. But these little things are, as it were, passed by with a kind of twinkle for apology, as by a well-bred man who does openly some little solecism which is too slight for direct mention, and which a meaner man might hide or avoid. Unless you are very modern indeed, you twinkle back at the bird. But otherwise, there is nothing visible of the havoc and the prey and plunder. It is certain that much of the visible life passes violently into other forms, flashes without pause into flame, but not all. Amid all the killing, there must be much dying. There are, for instance, few birds of prey left in our more accessible counties now, and many thousands of birds must die uncaught by a hawk and unpierced. But if their killing is so done modestly, so then is their dying also. Short lives have all these wild things, but there are innumerable flocks of them always alive. They must die, then, in innumerable flocks. And yet they keep the millions of the dead out of sight. Now and then, indeed, they may be betrayed. It happened in a cold winter. The late frosts were so sudden, and the famine so complete, that the birds were taken unawares. The sky and the earth conspired that February to make known all the secrets. Everything was published. Death was manifest. Editors, when a great man dies, are not more resolute than the frost of 95. The birds were obliged to die in public. They were surprised and forced to do thus. They became like Shelley in the monument, which the art and imagination of England combined to raise to his memory at Oxford. Frost was surely at work in both cases, and in both it wrought wrong. There's a similarity of unreason in betraying the death of a bird and in exhibiting the death of Shelley. The death of a soldier, passé, encore. But the death of Shelley was not his goal, and the death of the birds is so little characteristic of them that, as has just been said, no one in the world is aware of their dying, except only in the case of birds in cages, who again are compelled to die with observation. The woodland is guarded and kept by a rule. There is no display of the battlefield and the fields. There is no tale of the game bag, no boast. The hunting goes on, but with strange decorum. You may pass a fine season under the trees and see nothing dead except here and there where a boy has been by, or a man with a trap, or a man with a gun. There is nothing like a butcher's shop in the woods. But the biographers have always had other ways than those of the wild world. They will not have a man to die of sight. I have turned over scores of lives, not to read them, but to see whether now and again there might be a life which was not more emphatically a death. But there never is a modern biography that has taken the hint of nature. One and all, these books have disproportionate illness, the death out of all scale. Even more wanton than the disclosure of a death is that of a mortal illness. If the man had recovered, his illness would have been rightly his own secret. But because he did not recover, it is assumed to be news for the first comer. Which of us would suffer the details of any physical suffering, over and done in our own lives, to be displayed and described? This is not a confidence we have a mind to make, and no one is authorized to ask for attention or pity on your behalf. The story of pain ought not be told of us, seeing that by us it would assuredly not be told. There's only one other thing that concerns a man still more exclusively, and that is his own mental illness, or the dreams and delusions of a long delirium. When he is in common language, not himself, a man should be made for so bitter a paradox. He should be allowed such solitude as is possible to the alienated spirit. He should be left to the not himself, and spared the intrusion against which he can so ill guard that he could hardly have even resented it. The double helplessness of delusion and death should keep the door of Rossetti's house, for example, and refuse him to the reader. His mortal illness had nothing to do with his poetry. Some rather affected objection is taken every now and then to the publication of some facts, others being already well known in the life of Shelley. Nevertheless, these are all, properly speaking, biography. What is not biography is the detail of the accident, of the manner of his death, the detail of his cremation. Or if it was to be told briefly, it was certainly not for marble. Shelley's death had no significance, except inasmuch as he died young. It was a detachable and disconnected incident. Ah, what a frost of fancy, and of the heart that used it so, dealing with an insignificant fact, and conferring a futile immortality. Those are ill-named biographers who seem to think that a betrayal of the ways of death is a part of their ordinary duty, and that if material enough for a last chapter does not lie to their hand, they are to search it out. They, of all survivors, are called upon, in honor and reason, to look upon death with more composure. To those who love the dead closely, this is, for a time, impossible. To them, death becomes, for a year, disproportionate. Their dreams are fixed upon it, night by night. They have in those dreams to find the dead in some labyrinth. They have to mourn his dying, and to welcome his recovery in such a mingling of distress and of always incredulous happiness as it is not known even to dreams, save in that first year of separation. But they are not biographers. If death is the privacy of the woods, it is the more conspicuously secret, because it is their only privacy. You may watch, or may surprise everything else. The nest is retired, not hidden. The chase goes on everywhere. But it is wonderful how the perpetual chase seems to cause no perpetual fear. The songs are all audible. Life is undefended, careless, nimble, and noisy. It is a happy thing that minor artists have ceased, or almost ceased, to paint dead birds. Time was when they did it continually in that British school of watercolor art, Stipple, of which surrounding nations, it was agreed, were envious. They must have killed their bird to paint him, for he is not to be caught dead. A bird is more easily caught alive than dead. A poet, on the contrary, is easily, too easily caught dead. Minor artists now seldom stifle the bird on its back. But a good sculptor and a university together modeled their Shelley on his back, unessentially drowned, and everybody may read about the sick mind of Dante Rossetti. Thank you for listening to Sleepy. Good night.